the parties early on decided that they needed to put the victims at the center of their efforts, because the conflict in Colombia had produced so many victims. So it was important to hear their stories, get their views, in order to get best possible agreement, and in order to get an agreement that was durable in time.
That's Dag Nylander describing the unprecedented move by the Colombian government and the FARC guerrillas to place victims at the heart of their peace negotiations, a move that fostered a shared commitment and propelled the parties towards reaching a resolution. Dag is a Norwegian diplomat and is currently the director of the Norwegian Center for Conflict Resolution. Before his current role at the center, he was director and head of the Section for Peace and Reconciliation in the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Throughout his career, he's held several diplomatic positions, most notably as mediator and Norwegian special envoy to Colombia. From 2010 to 2016, he led the Norwegian facilitation of the peace process between the Colombian government and the FARC. This work built on the foundations laid from 2006 to 2008 when he headed the Norwegian embassy in Bogota. In 2017, he was appointed the United Nations Secretary General's personal representative on the border controversy between Venezuela and Guyana. Dag is a jurist by education and has practiced both as a lawyer and assistant judge. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, and in this episode of Conflict, Power, and Persuasion, Dag delves into his extensive experience, sharing his seasoned insights from the front lines of high-stakes international mediation and negotiation. Some topics discussed include Dag's insights on the most crucial actions a mediator can take to ensure a successful outcome, crafting a secure environment for participants, considering political, legal, and physical aspects, cultivating trust between the parties and the mediator, and the pivotal role this plays in the mediation's success, navigating the ethical complexities of stakeholder inclusivity while keeping the process efficient, the transformative impact of placing victims at the heart of peace talks, an exploration of Track 2 diplomacy, its effectiveness, and best practices within peace processes, and much more.
This is Conflict, Power, and Persuasion. Podcast of the Canadian International Institute of Applied Negotiation.
Hey, Dag. Thanks a lot for joining me.
How are you? I'm great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So I've provided a brief overview of your professional background in the intro, but in your own words, can you just tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. Norwegian, from Oslo, a lawyer by education, has spent most of my working years at the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, with some stints outside of government service, you know, working for the United Nations Secretary General, also on mediation-related issues. I've been working as an assistant judge, as a lawyer in Norway. But mainly I've been doing international politics, working on behalf of the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, spent way too much time in Latin America, working on Colombia, Venezuela, Guyana, bunch of issues. And then obviously other places as well, Middle East, Asia, Africa. So yeah, there you have it. Mostly mediation, negotiations, stuff like that.
Right on. We'll get into all that. Curious how you made the shift from your legal practice into the world of diplomacy and international relations.
Yeah. It's with most people, you know, some planning, some interests, and lots of coincidence has brought me to where I am. I've always had a strong interest in diplomacy, international politics. Then I studied law, of course, but it became increasingly clear to me while studying that I wanted to work in diplomacy. So that was basically where I oriented myself after finalizing law school in Oslo, got into the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, started first posting at the embassy in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And that was really where I first got my early interactions with with people that had worked in mediation and peace processes, because at that time, towards the end of the millennium, Buenos Aires was visited by the then Colombian president, who was conducting a peace negotiations with the Colombian guerrilla group FARC. So the president was in the Colombian president, Andrés Pastrana was in Buenos Aires, presenting his strategy and the ongoing negotiations with the FARC, and that struck me as highly interesting. And then I met Pastrana and his people again in New York a couple of years later. Norway served at the Norwegian Security Council together with Colombia, and then I sort of got my hands on peace and reconciliation issues and the Colombians again. So that was really my, you know, the start of my interaction with peace negotiations and Latin America. And then, of course, I've you know, at a number of times throughout my career at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I've tried to escape diplomacy by checking out other areas of interest, but I've always been drawn back to diplomacy. One of the things that sort of convinced me to try something different was that as a diplomat, you seldom see direct results, concrete results of your work, at least not every day or every week or every month. So, you know, working as a lawyer, working as a judge, you got to interact with people in real time and make decisions that impacted lives of real people, rather than working on, you know, long-term policy issues. But still, I was always drawn back to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and diplomacy because, you know, sitting outside of the ministry, you always wonder what is really happening in the world. You sort of miss the, you know, the thorough reporting and the inside information. So I've always been pulled back. So that's my destiny, to work with international affairs and diplomacy.
Great. And I understand you've written a book about your experience with the Colombia FARC talks, which I'd like to get to. But I'd like to structure this conversation around the various hats you've worn as a negotiator, a mediator, and then end on the FARC talks. So perhaps we can start with negotiation. Can you give us an overview of the various situations you've worked in the capacity as a negotiator?
Well, I guess my first, you know, outside of the private sphere, of course, because, you know, everyday life is full of small and big negotiations, you know, walking to work, meeting colleagues, even family issues have elements of negotiations, obviously. But in terms of my professional life, it was multilateral negotiations at the United Nations, negotiating on behalf of Norway, various, you know, multilateral issues, human rights resolutions at the UN, for example, and highly complex negotiations with, you know, all member states being part of negotiations, and, you know, really, you know, finding a strategy together with partners, you know, often with European partners, with the Americans, with the Canadians, with Latin Americans, often at the United Nations, really dividing the tasks amongst ourselves. You know, we have a joint goal of adopting a human rights resolution in a specific direction. We would basically divide the tasks between the countries and work out a strategy to be able to get to the preferred end result. So I guess multilateral negotiations is my first interaction with negotiations in my professional life. And that gave me, I guess, an interesting, you know, experience and a good background when I entered into more bilateral negotiations, primarily in the sphere of peace talks in various places. So, you know, the Colombian peace process, obviously, we will get back to that. And also, you know, border issues in Latin America. So, you know, a number of negotiating situations where I've been trying to do my to do my part. And currently, of course, as director of the Norwegian Center for Conflict Resolution, where we are engaged many places in the world, I also get to sit back and advise people that work this organization when they are engaged with parties on all continents.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned strategy a couple times, and I'd like to talk about that for a bit. Do you have a general strategy that you use approaching a negotiation, so preparations and whatnot? I know each one's going to be different, but what are your first steps or your line of thinking or any sort of tips at all that you think helps contribute to a successful outcome?
Well, in terms of facilitation and mediation of negotiations, where there's obviously a strategy that we follow, which is very different from when you are a negotiating party yourself. So as a mediator, you will always try to make sure that the negotiating parties have a strong ownership to the process. It's very difficult to come as an outsider when you are dependent on trust from both parties, to sort of design the process and to be forward-leaning in terms of both how the process is designed and, you know, the speed of the negotiations and even the outcome of the negotiations. So you really need to make sure that the parties are on board, that they are comfortable. And in order for you to get there, you need to have a very solid understanding of what's at stake for the parties and a solid understanding of the positions and the interests of the parties. But really getting the parties' ownership to a process is fundamental. From a Norwegian perspective, we are not, you know, mediators who can dictate an outcome, obviously. There's a limit to what we can do in terms of convincing the parties other than with sound arguments and a well-structured process. So, you know, being humble in terms of our approach and humble in terms of what we can achieve and very clear on the fact that it's really up to the parties to find solutions to their conflict. And then, of course, along the way, we can be helpful in helping them get to an understanding and nudging them forwards when there's a need for it. But ideally, we would provide a safe place for the parties to negotiate in, and then the solutions will flow from there.
Okay, so we've moved into mediation, which is great because you've given some great tips there. You mentioned the importance of the parties to feel ownership over the process. You mentioned the importance of the mediator to really understand what's at stake for the parties in addition to their positions and interests, which is also a great one. The direct yet wider implications of the talks, which at this scale can impact a large number of stakeholders. So a big piece of work just there. And finally, your goal to create a safe space. Okay, so let's keep moving with mediation then. Mediation is assisted negotiation. To what extent would you say your experiences as a negotiator enhance your effectiveness as a mediator?
I find it somewhat difficult to sort of draw the line from my own experiences as a negotiator to being a mediator in these kinds of conflicts, because, you know, there's so much at stake in the conflicts that we have been mediating. And I think just recognizing that there's, you know, enormous interests at stake, and, you know, politically and personally for the people around the table, it's difficult to sort of compare my own experience as a negotiator with what the parties in a conflict where Norway is mediating is dealing with. So I find it somewhat difficult to sort of make that leap between negotiation and mediation.
You mentioned creating a safe space and the importance of that. How do you do that?
Well, I mean, we're talking about a safe space in various ways. You know, one is creating a safe space in terms of space that is safe physically. We're often, you know, dealing with parties in armed conflict, so it's really to extract people from zones of conflict and making sure that they can get safely from place A to place B, and that the negotiating environment is physically safe for them. And that's a very complex task, to design a process, particularly when we're talking about, you know, a hot conflict where the fighting is ongoing, while the early phases of talks, when exploration is going on, maybe in full secrecy, where there are, you know, few people involved, limited sharing of information within an armed group, and, you know, between a government negotiating panel and the armed forces, for example, there's a number of, you know, particular challenges that needs to be dealt with. And there's also a question of making sure that the space we create is safe in terms of, you know, legal safety, judicial safety. You know, many of the people that we talk to and try to bring to a negotiating table have a bounty on their head. They're, you know, wanted by a national government, even sought by the Interpol. That's always an issue throughout the talks, from the early exploratory phase to the negotiations to an eventual implementation of a peace agreement. And then there is the safe political space for parties to talk, and along with that goes the need to make sure that the parties have a sound strategy for communication, how to deal with information, how to inform their constituency, the armed personnel in their group, the broader public about what is going on, making sure that not only the parties but the people have a sense of ownership to what is going on. So that's what I mean by creating a safe space, mm-hmm. Politically, legally, and physically.
What about trust? Do you make efforts to build trust either between the parties or between the parties and the mediation team?
Yes, I've had many, many interesting discussions with parties and colleagues about the issue of trust. And I've come to the sense that the most important thing is really to try to build trust between the parties and you as a mediator. People tend to spend a lot of time focusing on the need to build trust between the parties. It's really more a question of the parties trusting you as a mediator, and maybe more importantly, the parties trusting the process that you help them set up. So they need to trust the process, not necessarily each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they can't trust each other, they can trust the mediator and the process. Any specific tactics there, or just relating to them and demonstrating that you're trustworthy? In a sense, or is there anything specifically you do to try to really foster that?
Well, I think the most important tool there is being with the parties over time. You know,
right.
Talk to them, meet with them over months and years. Being with them when things are not looking good, when there is no outlook for a negotiated settlement. Hanging around when everyone else are going elsewhere, you know, to following the headline of the day. Stick with the parties over time and make sure that they are confident that you don't have any ulterior motives, because that is often what we're met with early on when you start talking to people, be it in government or within an armed group, that they wonder what your interest is. You know, what is your personal interest? What is your what does the Norwegian government want out of this? And, you know, eventually convince them that our, you know, only interest or main interest is to assist them to reach an agreement, that we don't have a predesigned outcome of the talks, that we always strive to be impartial, to be balanced, even if it's often easy to see that we align politically with one party rather than the other, but that in spite of that, that we manage to be impartial in our dealings with the parties and how we design the process.
I was just going to ask about that, about how you build trust, but you know, balance that with remaining impartial. So you beat me to it. Let's shift into ethics then, sort of on a similar topic. Are there any ethical dilemmas you face? And I don't know if you have any examples or could speak about any, but any ethical dilemmas you faced as a mediator or a negotiator, and how you navigated it?
Yeah, I think I've met many dilemmas. You know, one being that we, as mediators, we try to be as inclusive as possible, but there's always this balance that you have to strike between being inclusive to the maximum extent and at the same time ensuring that dialogue and negotiations are as effective as possible. So you need to control the process tightly. You need to make sure that you let the right people into the process at the right time. You don't want a negotiating table flooded with people. So you need to be quite selective in terms of who you invite in and at what point you invite them in. For example, in the peace process in Colombia between the government and the FARC, the parties early on decided that they needed to put the victims at the center of their efforts, because the conflict in Colombia had produced so many victims. So it was important to hear their stories, get their views in order to get best possible agreement, and in order to get an agreement that was durable in time. So we were often met with that dilemma that you needed to sort of make sure that there were guardrails and that we let people and organizations, civil society, various interest groups, we needed to have them at the table, but we needed to have the right amount, we needed to have the right representatives, and we needed to have them at the right time. So we would sort of always be guarding the negotiating table jealously, and that would sometimes create, you know, obvious frictions. So I think that's one of the ethical dilemmas I get, I guess, that you meet as a mediator, being as inclusive as possible, but at the same time protecting the parties and the efficacy of the talks. Mm.
You're saying the Colombian government and the FARC group, the parties, decided that they want to put the victims at the center of the talks. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Wow. It's almost like building reconciliation into the process at the same time. What sort of effect do you think that had on the talks in general and overall?
I think first it was something that was agreed between the parties very early on in the talks in the secret phase, when there was only five or six from each party around the table, and it was easy for them to agree on as a principle. We need to put the victims at the center, and I think concretely what led the parties to agree on such a principle was reluctance by the FARC initially to put precise descriptions of transitional justice, the rights of victims, human rights into the early documents. Not because they were against it, but because it was in a phase where they had the representatives of the FARC did not have sufficient instructions. These were issues that hadn't been discussed sufficiently internally. So the reluctance to put what they might fear be commitments early on paper. So to find, you know, a round formulation, you know, victims at the center of our efforts was a way of, you know, opening up the space for future definition of what that should mean. So that was an early agreement between the parties that was very important. And then it also became some sort of a rallying cry for the parties whenever the talks were in difficulties. It would be good to sort of tell each other and the outside world that this is something we do for the victims. We need to get back on track because of the victims. We need to protect future victims from violation, etc. This is not about us. It's about the Colombian people, historic and future victims, etc. So we sort of created a sound footing for the parties in the way that they talked about the peace process. And then the fact that they brought victims to the table to hear their stories, to get their inputs on the negotiations eventually, was also hugely important. And I remember when we had the first victims sit down with the two parties telling their stories, that was a moment of great significance for the two parties. There were, you know, victims that had survived, you know, gruesome violations and attacks from both sides, and there were, you know, victims and perpetrators around the table listening to each other, and that was really giving all of us in the room a sense that this process is approaching a moment of no return. It's going to be really difficult not to push forward, and it brought an element of not seriousness, but an element of two parties having invested so much in the process, and that they really needed to find a negotiated settlement to this, not because of themselves, but because the responsibility they felt towards the victims that they had met in flesh and blood around the table. So that, I think, it was hugely important for the parties to agree on this principle. And then, of course, when a peace agreement was eventually reached and a truth commission was set up and the system for special jurisdiction to deal with past crimes was set up, that also built on this early principle to put the victims at the center of the efforts. That was hugely, hugely important.
Yeah, sounds like an incredibly powerful approach, sort of this joint goal, just motivating the parties to work together. That's wonderful. Let's shift to your book then. Maybe you could just start with a quick Cole's notes on the actual dispute between the FARC and Colombia, your involvement, and then just a bit about the book.
Sure. Well, I started working with peace processes in Colombia seriously in 2006, when I first got to Bogota to head our embassy there. And at that moment, Norway was engaged in peace talks between the government and a smaller guerrilla group, the ELN. And so that was my first sort of engagement with the Colombian guerrilla. And then eventually those talks broke down a couple of years later, and I continued staying in touch with not only government representatives, but the ELN guerrilla, people close to the guerrilla, civil society, and similarly on the FARC side, which at that point was Colombia's largest guerrilla group. And I was doing this in spite of the fact that we have failed in helping the ELN and the government to reach an agreement and the talks have broken down. I went back to Oslo, and then I somehow managed to convince myself and, more importantly, my superiors at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that we needed to continue to work in Colombia, even though the peace process had broken down in 2008. We needed to continue to work with the parties. And our hope was that we would be able to bring the ELN back to the table, and that was my main task for several years. And then in 2010, lots of things had already happened that sort of prepared the ground for peace talks in Colombia, not with ELN, but with the FARC. The Colombian government had been successful in their fight against the guerrilla. A number of commanders had been killed. Their historical leaders had died. There were more younger, more people, more interested and ready and more prepared for peace talks in the FARC leadership. And then we had a new Colombian president in 2010, who immediately, after being elected on a platform of continued war against the FARC, immediately turned and said publicly on the day of his inauguration that he was ready to sit down and talk to the FARC. So that was really the start of the peace process with them. And the conflict, of course, went back 5 decades, and it was, at least historically, an armed conflict that had grown out of the lack of political participation, political marginalization of, you know, large parts of Colombian society, and a very uneven distribution of land historically in that country. So that was really the early motivation of the Colombian guerrilla about the ELN and the FARC. When I first went into the Colombian wild to meet with FARC representatives, you know, the first I spoke to a young guerrilla fighter, and I asked her, you know, what had convinced her to join the guerrilla, and she had joined when she was 17, she told me, and that was what she said. This is a historic fight for justice. More even distribution of land and political participation, and those two core issues, and was to become a central part of the agenda that the parties agreed on. So the book is really about, you know, my first interactions with in Colombia with the ELN, eventually with the FARC, and the very long and thorny peace process that took place first in Venezuela, in the early exploratory phase, and then was moved to Havana, Cuba, where we sat for several years and negotiated all these issues.
Yeah, you mentioned a number of variables that made the dispute ripe. Loss of certain commanders, the age demographics, so there's younger blood around that were open to talks. Then the newly elected president as well, and his commitment to engage with the FARC. But can you just take us to the early days and how the talks really solidified? You mentioned you continued to be engaged with the ELN, so you were on the ground. Maybe you could just pick it up there.
Yeah, well, in 2009, 2010, I was still convinced that we should start with the ELN and that the FARC would follow after that. You know, ELN was more accessible. They had relatively fresh experience in negotiating with the government, and our dialogue with them and the government at that time was relatively promising. So the hope was that they would start moving, and then that the FARC would follow suit. The Colombian government and the representatives of President Santos was at that time in parallel already reaching out to the FARC. And we were asked in, it must have been early 2011, by the government, if we were also interested in helping out with the FARC. So not only the ELN, but also with the FARC. Something that we responded positively to. And then the work started to get acquainted with and trust the and build the necessary trust between the FARC and us, the US. They had worked with Norwegians before. Norway had been part of previous peace talks between the government and the FARC. And thanks to the efforts of the Venezuelan government, we were able to meet with FARC commanders in Venezuela and carefully build the necessary trust and be part of the mechanism that was set up in order to establish protocols for extracting FARC commanders from the Colombian jungle to Venezuela and eventually to Cuba.
Mm-hmm. The book then, how did you approach your book to document? There's obviously a lot that happened. How do you distill that into a book?
Yeah, that wasn't easy. I started writing around 2015, you know, in parallel with the peace talks. Not very successfully because I really didn't have the time and energy to sort of write a book while the talks were ongoing. But I had very good notes. And when the peace process was over, you know, a peace agreement was signed, I left the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to work for the United Nations. I brought my notebooks to New York and I sat there and I had some more success in sort of distilling my notes. I made a couple of honest efforts to write the book, but then one thing took the other and eventually I put the whole project in the drawer. And then in 2020, probably, I was sitting in Oslo talking with a friend of mine who is a Norwegian journalist. And she told me, well, you need to write this book. Let me help you. And so eventually we wrote the book together, which was a huge asset to have her on board. So we based the book on my early drafts and my notes. And then in addition to that, we interviewed lots of people, ex-FARC, ex-government, to sort of piece this together. Because the difficulty of writing about the Colombian peace process is that it was an extremely complex process, a very solid peace agreement with many, many details, many actors involved over many years with many crises and things that you could possibly cover in a book. So we needed to find the stories that could illustrate the challenges and solutions that the parties eventually found. We couldn't tell the full story, but we need to sort of select elements over those 10 years or so that the book covers to give leave the correct impression with the reader of what had happened and what the end result was. And I mean, the book is really written from a Norwegian perspective, and that it also makes it unique. I think it's not written by one of the parties, it's not written by a Colombian, but it's written by an outsider with a seat around the table. Yeah. In this case, it happened to be me and with the Norwegian government. So it's a unique and I believe balanced and impartial recount of what happened in the Colombian peace process.
Right on. We'll put a link up to it. Returning to the victims, do you feel they experienced justice? And just more broadly speaking, like how crucial do you think it is for justice in achieving durable peace?
I think it's fundamental for the victims to feel that they are, their views are taken into account, that they are heard, that they are seen. Without that, it's difficult to envision a peace agreement that will survive in the long term. Whether the peace agreement brought and brings justice, I mean, that's a That's a very difficult question to answer in general terms, and so it depends on who you ask, obviously. I think one of the striking things, at least for me in that particular process, was that it was really the victims, the direct victims of conflict, that most readily expressed an interest in forgiving. All of the victims that I spoke to, very few exceptions, understood that it was necessary to forgive and find solutions that were suboptimal in terms of reparations, I guess, in order for Colombia to move forwards, in order for them personally to move forwards and to avoid, you know, future victims. And I've heard countless times victims talk about, I'm willing to do my share so that no one else needs to experience the same that I have experienced. So the victims took a very forward-leaning position. You know, there were some spoilers to this peace process, obviously. And those spoilers, the most vocal ones, the most influential ones, were people that were somewhat more distanced to the conflict. They were often not the ones that had suffered the direct consequences of the conflict. So we, to distill it in a way, you know, going to Bogota and speaking to people with resources, living a, you know, good life, having influence, money, the skepticism was huge amongst many. But when you went out to the countryside to speak to people that had really suffered the conflict, then the readiness to move forwards and to forgive seemed much greater. And I think that was a big paradox for me.
Sensitive to your time, I know it's early evening there. Maybe we can just end on getting your perspective on track two processes, since we've been on track one and you should have some good inputs here. Wondering about what you feel are some of the most effective efforts, considering the three timestamps of before violent conflict, during talks, and post-conflict efforts. Do you feel there's any sort of initiatives that stand out over others that really make an impact in track two processes? Or, I mean, each situation is going to be unique, but to you, are there any efforts that stand out?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, track two processes is, you know, part of what we do here at my organization. You know, we do a lot of track two. It's always difficult to talk about, you know, peace work and, you know, the importance of dialogue, the importance of bringing people together, particularly now, I would say, with the current, you know, climate internationally. And track two is even more difficult than track one. And it's measuring results in this field, be it track one or track two, is complicated. We do a lot of track two processes that are useful, beneficial, but it's difficult to see, you know, the concrete impact of what you do. But what often happens is when you bring together a track two process, track two actors, you sort of get perspectives and you meet people, and suddenly there's an opening in a totally unexpected direction. And that is what you need to jump on. So, you know, much more than in track one, I find track two to be some sort of a Pandora's box. No one knows what might pop up, and you need to be ready to pursue the possibilities that arise. But we do a lot of track two. It's difficult for me to sort of pinpoint the particular track two that is more promising than the other. But in Colombia, for example, before I joined this organization, when I was at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, you know, in parallel with what we were doing, as a state actor, this organization, NOREF, was pursuing, you know, track-through dialogue meetings, so, which eventually became complementary to what we were doing in track one. So in Colombia, those two tracks sort of neatly fit together towards the middle of the process. And I find that the appetite for track two is huge, even if there's sometimes difficulties in getting, you know, enthusiasm in government quarters for track two initiatives, particularly when, you know, the international climate is as it is today. But exactly now, when parties tend to talk less directly, I think track two is increasingly important and a big part of what we do here at NOREF.
I agree that the importance of track two processes, and really great if you could have them mesh with track one, however that might look. Well, thanks so much, Doug, for coming on and sharing your rich experiences in negotiation and mediation. I really look forward to reading the book. So thanks again.
Thank you. It's been great. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening. If you want to hear more from international experts digging into a range of topics on conflict, power, and persuasion, subscribe to your favorite podcast app or visit us at cn.org. That's CIIAN.org.